to build housing in this neighborhood, and we're going to, you know, those folks, maybe they're deservedly, you know, what did they do wrong? They should have had, you know, better fire and earthquake insurance, right? Like, it wasn't a time where we're trying to point blame or have any notion of where the person failed. We looked at where society failed, where systems failed, and how they can be strengthened. And what we saw is some of the earliest examples in this country of scattershot housing, where still to this day there are earthquake cottages that were paid off $2 a month to $50, paid off, and then brought from Golden Gate Park to a spot in San Francisco. And then suddenly your neighbor who was formerly homeless is now your house neighbor. They're no longer your homeless neighbor. And by, I think it was 2 years after the earthquake and fire, the entire park was clear because everyone had been housed. Everyone had found housing. So that's a very high level, you know, I mean, we could talk about issues in the criminal justice system where it's becomes increasingly difficult to find employment, to get federal benefits, the challenges that people have accessing benefit programs that we have a pretty meager social safety net. And even that social safety net is largely inaccessible. To accept the housing choice voucher if they can choose, and you can't discriminate, but you know, it happens. So there's a lot of policy prescriptions in the book that especially my co-author Don Burns, who's a scholar of homeless policies of the last four decades, it was really an honor to write it with him. I think it fundamentally begins with our hearts and minds. And I think if we change our hearts and minds and get to know the relational aspect, I have enough confidence that we'll then vote for and fight for the policies that
done with these, we'll move on to a more interactive discussion, maybe about practical steps that people can take themselves to address homelessness. In August, Together SF Action published a research report describing excessive city bureaucracy and limited mayoral power as two roots of the city's inability to address and support those experiencing homelessness. How can this be addressed?
Wow. Okay. My view, generally, I don't know if I have brilliant thoughts on what's going on in San Francisco right now. I'm frustrated. It seems like a lot of money has been spent with very little to show. And I think what happens is a situation where one side is saying, well, hey, city and homeless services, we've spent all this money and we have so little to show for it. What's going on, right? We need change. And I think there's a lot of, you have no idea how many people would be experiencing homelessness if we weren't doing what we're doing, right? Like for every one person who gets housed, three people end up on the streets. So then it's a prevention question. And we're trying to withhold floodwaters and it's just not strong enough as a barrier. And that's also true. I think the problem, though, that I'm seeing is there's a lot of truth in both sides of that discourse. But what's missed is this other system going on that's not just homeless services and city administration, not just prevention and keeping away from a much worse flood. It's the humanity aspect. Them? Are we talking with them? Do we know them by name? And do we understand and accept our role in what's going on? In just a few days, next week, there's a major event happening in San Francisco. There's a Chronicle article about how our neighbors experiencing homelessness are being pushed outside, just as we saw during the Super Bowl. Maybe we should actually does. It's not just San Francisco. And say, this is happening here, and it's going to happen in your city if it's not happening already. We have to get to know our neighbors as neighbors and not see them as people to just push away. So yeah, I think, I'm very frustrated with what's happening in the city, but I also personally feel more hopeful about this issue than I have in a long time. There's incredible people doing good work on this space, and we have found an increased willingness to innovation. That's what I'm excited about. 10 years ago, when I started this journey, the thought of tiny homes, small modular homes, or maybe lower cost construction methods being used, it was a non-starter. Mm-hmm. It was permanent supportive housing or shelters, encampments. And, you know, there wasn't much room between that. But the truth is, like, it's way too expensive to be able to develop the kind of housing we need. It's a yes and, not a yes but problem. So it's yes and we need more permanent supportive housing. And we also need housing units of the type that you or I would want to live in. I think that's a good litmus test that sometimes gets overlooked is, would you or I want to live in that situation? I wouldn't want to live in almost any of the shelters that I've ever visited. And again, not a knock on San Francisco, but to be in a congregate environment, hundreds of people that get in by this time, get out by that time, can't bring your stuff, can't bring your partner, really the homeless shelter, right? Like the monolith, just group everyone together. There's smaller ones that are incredible, doing good work, that are, you know, perhaps more focused on one identity or one experience, but I wouldn't want to be in that situation. Well, would I be willing to be in a 500 square foot tiny home where I have my own space and maybe, you know, share a restroom with a few other people, if that? Absolutely. Yeah, that's not, you know, maybe long term, but sure, that sounds like a pretty good quality of life, a dignified way to be. So I think that's a question we don't ask often enough, is we don't say, is this a situation or a circumstance in which we'd want to live? Or is it just, hey, here's this offering, why aren't you going there? You should accept it. And the last thing I'll just mention is in one of the chapters on paternalism, there's an incredible story. Is anyone familiar with the story of Ronnie Goodman, Ronnie the Runner? He's an incredible human being. He passed away a few years ago. He was a person experiencing homelessness. He got out of San Quentin and dedicated his life to art and running. He ran in the San Francisco Marathon and raised, I think, well over $10,000 for charitable causes. So he's running, and he made incredible, incredible artwork. He had an offer of housing in the Tenderloin, and he told me this one day. And I kind of looked at him. I was like, well, Ronnie, you're currently living in a tent. Wouldn't you want to get into the housing unit if you could? That seems like a logical thing to take advantage of. And he kind of looked at me, you know, real patiently, like, well, Kevin, that housing unit is in a building where drugs are present 24/7. And I have an addiction history. And if I get back in that unit, I am going to relapse and not make it. And what went in my mind from this paternalistic, wow, judging Ronnie for making this very poor life decision, it then shifted to, that makes a lot of sense. That's a really good point. I think you're making a very logical decision. You know, hoping that that level of kind of familiarity and getting to know folks at that kind of level of intimacy can drive policy in a way that it's not right now.
So maybe one more question, and then let's go to a discussion. And this leads us right into it. How do you recommend the average person better get to know their unhoused neighbors safely, respectfully, and genuinely?
Okay, so I was thinking about this before, and I want to share this with all of you. You tell me if it resonates or not. I think of an acronym, and the first letter is imagine. So imagine the person that you're seeing as you're walking by, and when you talk about homelessness, imagine that's someone's son or daughter, because it turns out they are. And perhaps the next step is connect. Get to know that person then in a relational way that's not seeing them as a problem to be solved, but seeing them as a person to be loved. Connect them, and whether it's with our phone buddy program, we right now have a wait list of neighbors experiencing homelessness looking for volunteer friends. We have more neighbors who are unhoused who have raised their hand and said, I need someone to talk to, and we don't have enough volunteers. 30 minutes a week, phone call, text message. So connect, whether it's phone buddies, whether it's visiting a shelter, a soup kitchen, talking to someone in your community, in your neighborhood, who's experiencing homelessness. And then the third letter is unite. And unite both as people, because fundamentally they're a person first before they're experiencing homelessness, right? It's first person. So unite kind of this shared, these are our neighbors, this is one community. Our neighbors who are unhoused were once our neighbors who were housed, right? More than 70% of people who are homeless in San Francisco were once housed in San Francisco. More than 90% of people who are homeless in California were once housed in California. So fundamentally, these are our neighbors. And then also unite connecting the relationships we have and the stories we're hearing and the issues we're kind of co-discovering with policies, with what's happening in our city, with what's not. When we talk about criminal justice system, when we talk about affordable housing, when we talk about income inequality, or when we talk about healthcare disparities, we should all have someone whose name and face we can think of. So that, if you spell it out, it's I-C-U. And my partner is an emergency medicine doctor, so there is a connection, if you think of it. But I see you, as in, yes, I am seeing you. So I think if we just remember, imagine, connect, unite, I see you, I think that's a starting point. But I would invite folks to just be in conversation. Would love to hear ideas. There's so much happening nationwide, exciting stuff happening in cities big and small. I would love to be able to showcase some of those ideas and innovations. We're doing that on our website, whenwewalkby.com, and then on social media. So I would love to hear from you also on, once you get close, once you're in relationship, once you're connecting what you're hearing and seeing to the broader issues in your community, what innovations and what approaches are needed. And it might just be, we need more funding for this program. We need to pass bond measures and be able to, you know, invest in housing. That's a huge part of it. So it's not saying we need to reinvent the wheel, not saying that this is a silver bullet on homelessness. I don't think there is. I think it's a starting point, and it's a human-centered starting point that, and the last thing I'll say, in a moment that feels like very frustrating in the world, a lot happening that feels overwhelming, incredibly sad, this is an issue that we actually have tremendous power to make a difference. This is not an issue out there. This is an issue not only in our cities, but on our blocks. And if it's not visible on your block, as in a person who's maybe outside an encampment, there's very likely family that's doubled up or tripled up. There's very likely a person who's one paycheck away, because half of the country right now is one paycheck away from not being able to pay rent. And 47% of Americans say they don't know where they could get $400 for an unexpected emergency. 47%. You almost have to start asking, why aren't tens of millions of people experiencing homelessness with those numbers? We never ask, why aren't there more people who are homeless? We always say, why are so many people homeless? Well, why aren't there more? And what we're finding is family, friends, community, church, synagogue, mosque, informal economy, relationships, social capital is making up the difference, doubling up, tripling up, small payments, loans, job offers. And if you don't have that, or you've lost that, or it's not resource rich enough to begin with, it can be incredibly difficult not only to not become homeless, but then to get back off the streets. Because people get into housing, but then they fall right back over the edge into homelessness because they've been put into four walls and a roof, but not had the community, the social support, the next time that there's an issue that they're going to face, and inevitably, you know, life's complicated and folks will face it. So I do think it starts with getting to know our neighbors as neighbors and being in those relationships.
Thanks, Kevin. So let's talk a bit with our community members who are here about the issue of homelessness and ideas about what can be done, practical steps. We've already told you everybody is going to take home a pair of Bombas socks. Please hand them to a person on the street who may be experiencing homelessness. We also will offer ability for people to sign up, say, for your Phone Buddies program. But we have some mics here. Let's hear from you all. What can be done? What are the needs? What would you like to offer to the discussion?
So your ICU. So the C was connect, and you said that pretty breezily, but I'm sitting here, I don't even know how to give away these socks. And I walk past people experiencing homelessness every day, and in my heart, that's someone God loves as much as God loves me, but I am terrified to approach them. And I don't mean because I think they're going to hurt me. I just mean because I do not know what to do. So could you act out how we give away the salt?
Sure. That sounds great. So what I started out with is basically just walking past and feeling incredibly helpless, overwhelmed, frustrated, and then maybe saying hi and then quickly kind of skirting off, right? So that's where I started. And what I found that's really helpful is if you're talking to someone who's unsheltered, perhaps the starting point could just be, hi, how are you? And it just pause and see if there's a reaction. And if the person doesn't show an interest in responding, that may be a sign to continue walking. And that's okay too. But I think if you do walk by, when you walk by, thinking for a little minute longer, why did I walk by? Is there anything I could have done? Did I choose to disengage because I felt afraid? Basically, what you just said is an incredible starting point. So to acknowledge fear, courage, vulnerability, uncertainty, I think you just exemplified what I'm saying in a really beautiful way, actually.
So Kevin, what would you say if you had to script?
So get down to a script, I'd say, hi, how are you? How long have you lived in the area? And then I'd ask something like, do you have any family or friends nearby? And that was a starting point for our programs. I also have said before, hey, I saw you sitting here. I wasn't quite sure what to say to you, but I thought I'd just introduce myself. The person who you're passing by is in a much more vulnerable situation than we are. One neighbor experiencing homelessness who suffered from schizophrenia reminded me in many ways of my uncle. I asked him, what do you wish we knew about your experience that we don't know? And his response to me was, I just wish people knew that I was so much more of a threat to myself than I would ever be to them. So I think it's just taking a moment to introduce ourselves, have a conversation. And I'll just say, you could go with a friend. Doesn't have to be by yourself. Go in broad daylight. We do outreach at Miracle Messages and would welcome you to join us and join our group and do an outreach in your community. And also most of what we see a fraction of people experiencing homelessness. We see a very unsheltered, sometimes very acute form of homelessness where there may be many other issues going on. And relationships are important in those cases, but there could be some medical issues, you know, addiction, substance abuse issues, which is much more prevalent on the streets. You know, you can also go to shelters, soup kitchens, volunteer. But I often just start a conversation by saying, hi, how are you? How long have you lived in the area? Do you have any family or friends nearby? And just introducing myself. And I, you know, pretty quickly can gauge whether someone is receptive to talk.
Thanks. Hi, I'm actually one of your volunteers, and I have a buddy, and she's terrific, and we talk every week for almost an hour, and it's wonderful. And I just wanted to comment about your first question about how we change things. I think one of them is we have to change the conversation, because what I didn't really realize, because the news just focuses on people who are drug addicted and living on the streets, is that she's homeless through no fault of her own. She lived in a house where the landlord died, the house was sold, and she was evicted. A few weeks later, she was in her car at a stop sign, and a drunk driver plowed into her. So she had a really good job, she's college educated, she cannot go to work. She's living on disability, and she's been living in a van for 5 years. Those are the kind of stories where people will feel, I don't know, much better or whatever, but see a whole different side, I think, of what unhoused is, rather than you're worrying about whether the person in the tent in your corner is going to be threatening to you. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an important part of a conversation you need to get out, too. I have to say there are some days when talking to her breaks my heart, but there are some days where we just laugh and we talk about the Beatles because she loves the Beatles. Mm-hmm. And we talk about music. She's my age. She has no family. Her parents are deceased. Her sisters are deceased. So she doesn't have all those other social mm-hmm. networks that you've been describing. And she's trying, but she hasn't just been able to break through. And so I just have to say there are so many phases of homelessness that I think if we could widen the picture, that might also help.
That's beautiful. And just as a question, since I'm interviewing everyone tonight, it seems, it sounds like not only your friend is benefiting from the relationship, but it sounds like you are as well.
Definitely. Yeah. On the login, you always say a positive note. I always have a positive note to say. She says, talking to you last week was, it's so great to have an intellectual conversation. because there's no one in the cars behind her or wherever that she feels she can have that. So
thanks for sharing that.
Positive. Yeah. So thank you.
Hi. I work for Episcopal Community Services of San Francisco. We are the largest provider of housing and supportive services in San Francisco, now in Marin, and soon to be San Mateo. I think my comment to you is more on, first of all, thank you for the work that you've been doing and the book. It's all incredibly impactful. And as a person who works in this sphere, I'm deeply grateful for what you're doing and what you're bringing to light, because it is so important. Mm. I think for me and for what I do for them and where I sit, my question is more on addressing the wider public and looking to misconceptions, misunderstandings, and speaking to the wider community on bringing to light these stories of experiences of homelessness and extreme poverty and how to be a light and a help to those who need.
Yeah, well said. ECES is one of our partners, and we're just grateful for the work you're doing. It's often thankless every day. And I think a big part of this is narrative change. Right. Like we've actually added, we say, you know, family reunifications, phone buddy program, basic income. But one area is just narrative change. And we've had individuals, you know, one individual who reached out to me is a paramedic. And she said, I am a paramedic. I see people experiencing homelessness every day in my line of work. And I see them often at a moment of tremendous need where someone perhaps is overdosed or there's a acute health crisis on the streets. And I never looked at those individuals as anything but problems until I saw one of your videos. And I realized that there's an entire backstory that a lot of neighbors who are on the streets might be self-medicating, that we often look at the cause of our individuals experiencing homelessness who are perhaps have a substance abuse issue as that substance abuse issue. Oftentimes, it's an effect. It's not a cause. The cause was upstream. There is fragility because there's plenty of people who are housed who have substance abuse issues. The difference is in a functioning society, you have access to some form of treatment and you can have your mental health issue or your substance addiction treated. Where our neighbors experiencing homelessness, it's incredibly difficult to do that. And then you add in all the dehumanization and the traumas and the health issues, those socks that we're handing out, those are specifically designed with antimicrobial fabrics to basically be worn day in and day out for days on an end because, you know, foot funguses and issues, if you're in inclement weather and you're wearing the socks and you can't change it in laundry facilities. So I do think narrative change is important. But fundamentally, no one should be experiencing homelessness in this country. We have way too many resources, way too much talent to put to this problem.
If I can say one thing about the resource question. When you were interviewing me, you asked me about my family situation. In Santa Clara County, where we live, the cost of serving a person experiencing homelessness is about $80,000 a year. That includes hospitals, police, jails, social services of all kinds, food programs, etc. Our family at this point spends, I would say, less than $15,000 a year, which includes a single family home in a less expensive area, and the taxes and insurance and utilities and social programs provide food stamps, social security disability, and health care. So if you're talking about a family, a church, a community trying to actually provide housing, it's not that expensive compared to what government entities spend on addressing the needs of one person experiencing homelessness. So this is something to keep in mind in terms of what can be accomplished in actually housing people who need it.
Yeah, and I would say plus one, agree on that. And what we've seen in our basic income pilot is most of the money folks are spending, a third of it is spent on housing, a third is spent on food security, and then the last third is everything from family emergencies where they're also looking out for family members and loved ones and others on the streets who may be in need. Service dogs to deal with disabilities, PTSD. And we've had many individuals make charitable donations when they receive the money. In fact, the first person who received the check from us, Elizabeth, the first thing she did was make a donation back to Miracle Messages. And when I said, you didn't need to do this, you know, that wasn't necessary, she said, well, I didn't do it for you. I did it for myself. So I could once again feel the dignity of being able to support the causes I believe in. And I think that that angle of being able to invest in our unhoused neighbors as neighbors and being amazed and excited by the results, I think we can see a lot more of that because we're already spending a lot on this issue. It's not a choice of whether we spend on this issue or not. It's where we invest and whether we trust our unhoused neighbors as neighbors.
Great point.
Yeah.
Well, we are at the end of our scheduled program. Our thanks to Kevin Adler, author of When We Walk By, Forgotten Humanity, Broken Systems, and the Role We Can Each Play in Ending Homelessness in America. I'm Gloria Duffy. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Kevin. See you the next time, and good luck in any efforts you make to do some outreach to our homeless neighbors. Thank you for joining us for the latest episode of the Commonwealth Club radio program. Today, you heard my conversation with Kevin Adler, founder and CEO of Miracle Messages. I'm Gloria Duffy, co-president and co-CEO of the club. Join us again next week to hear how to protect yourself from cybercrime. Until then, you can learn more about us and our events at commonwealthclub.org. Find thousands of our programs on Apple Podcasts, Audible, and YouTube. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us in person at the Commonwealth Club World Affairs of California. To hear the entire hour-long version of these conversations, download this program from the club's website or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Welcome to the Dave Koz Radio Show. We're so happy to have you and so glad you could spend some time with us together this weekend. And I'm particularly excited to be welcoming back one of the real superstars of our music, a guy who's had one heck of a career. Wow. Saxophonist Boney James is our very special guest right here in the studio. In addition to some great music and conversation with Boney, I've also got Warren Hill fessing up to something you probably didn't know about him, and it's a good one. And Brian Culbertson looks back on the moment it all changed for him and his career. There's also lots of great music on the way in the next 2 hours, including something from Najee, hear from the Reverend Al Green, Kenny G, Norah Jones, and more of your favorites this weekend. So thanks very much for listening to the Dave Koz Radio Show this weekend. Guitarist Norman Brown gets us going now with Pop's Cool Groove.